Google recently announced a partnership with a company called Lending Club. That's a website that connects people who need to borrow money with people who have money to lend. This is outside the conventional banking system. It's kind of like Match.com for money. Google's move is part of a growing activity in an industry called peer-to-peer lending. NPR's Wendy Kaufman reports.
Chanda Leger works for a bank, but when she wanted a loan to consolidate her credit card debt with its hefty interest rate, the bank didn't have much to offer. She tried other banks too, but even with her excellent credit score, she got nowhere. So Leger, who's in her 30s, went online seeking alternatives. She discovered Lending Club.
I went ahead and applied for the loan, and I was able to get it funded in 1 week, and my rate was 6%. So that's half of what I have been paying. I thought it was a really great experience from beginning to end. Really easy, you play online, and they gave you status updates.
Both Lending Club and its much smaller rival, a company called Prosper, have been around for several years. But lately, things have really taken off at both companies. Here's Renaud Laplanche, the CEO of Lending Club.
Last year, we facilitated about $800 million in loans, and we are planning on $2 billion this year.
The system works like this. Investors put up the money to fund the loans. Typically, they'll have pieces of hundreds, even thousands of loans, which are ranked according to risk. An investor's rate of return will vary accordingly. Laplanche says investors make a nice profit, but consumers still get lower rates than they would with a conventional lender because peer-to-peer lending operates like a marketplace.
It is a more direct funding process between the investors and the borrowers. There's no branch network. Everything happens online and we use technology to lower cost.
In the industry's early days, most of the money for loans came from individual investors. But today, and this is a big change, large institutional investors like insurance companies and pension funds have put up a lot of the cash.
That is about one simple thing, and it's called yield.
Peter Renton blogs and teaches courses about investing in peer-to-peer or P2P lending. He explains that in recent years, institutional investors have had a hard time finding good fixed-income investments, but P2P lending can offer that. And with more institutional money flowing in, the lenders can make more loans. We should note here that Peter Renton invests some of his own money in these P2P loans, and when he directs investors to Lending Club and Prosper, he gets referral fees. So what about Google's investment? It's not putting money into loans, but is making an investment in Lending Club itself. Neither company is saying exactly what they plan to do, but Renton and others speculate that Google sees synergies between Lending Club and Google Wallet, the company's virtual payment system. Imagine, for example, Google's own credit card or perhaps an instant big-ticket loan.
If you can hook up a loan institution who is really innovative that can get something happening quickly, there is the potential that Google Wallet could hook up with Lending Club and you could go buy a car on your cell phone.
Indeed, Lending Club's Renaud Laplanche has grand ambitions. He wants to make small business loans, student loans, car loans, even mortgage loans. For him, the multi-trillion-dollar market for consumer credit is a giant opportunity.
It's really one of the few large markets that has not been fully transformed by the internet. So we believe we can become the mainstream alternative to the banking system.
But David Scher, who follows banking and investment services at the research firm Gartner, says P2P lenders won't be putting conventional banks out of business anytime soon.
They're growing steadily, but realize they're growing off of a very small base. Their total volume of lending might be what a small two or three branch community bank does in a year.
And he says it can take a long time for consumers to change their behavior when it comes to banking. Wendy Kaufman, NPR News.
Next month, a federal judge will decide whether to approve a settlement in a class action lawsuit against Facebook that could affect more than 70 million Americans. The suit began when Facebook started using the likes and pictures of its users as endorsements in ads the company calls sponsored stories. As NPR's Steve Henn reports, a number of groups are calling the proposed settlement unfair.
Facebook started this ad program, Sponsored Stories, back in 2011. And it works like this. If I click on a like button next to a product, say Coke, Facebook can then use my picture to send an ad to my friends saying, Steve Henn likes Coke. The more you click on like buttons, the more ads you can appear in. Facebook also started doing this with clicks and likes it collected from kids.
I have three children, and two are on Facebook.
Kim Natalie Parsons says she was furious when she realized her daughter's photos were being used in ads on Facebook without her knowledge or permission.
It was brought to our attention by another friend of ours who is linked to my daughter on Facebook.
Parsons says her community in Hermitage, Tennessee is tight-knit.
We do a lot of watching each other's children, making sure that nothing is getting missed by the parent. And her picture was posted with an ad
for a local ice cream store. At first, Parsons thought her 13-year-old had managed to sneak away and visit the ice cream shop without her knowledge. Then she realized she hadn't. Her kid had just clicked a like button online. And it turned out her daughter had clicked like buttons more than 230 times.
I should not have to come in as the parent on the back end trying to protect my child. That should be understood.
Actually, it turns out a lot of states, including California, have laws on the books that ban companies from using people's images in advertising without explicit permission.
There is a very strong legal case here.
Heidi Lee Feldman's a law professor at Georgetown who specializes in class action torts and ethics.
This is bad behavior. They intentionally and knowingly appropriated people's images without getting their permission for commercial use.
Quickly, the company was hit with a class action lawsuit. By the summer of 2012, Facebook caved and tried to settle, offering $20 million. Scott Mitchellman is an attorney at Public Citizen.
Well, the settlement agreement had a number of problems, the major one being that no money was ever to go to class members under any circumstances.
Instead, $10 million was supposed to go to the plaintiff's attorneys who brought the case, and $10 million was supposed to go to charity. A federal judge rejected that deal, ruling it was unfair to Facebook users like Kim Parsons. Now, Facebook is trying to settle the case again.
The second deal looks in many respects like the first. Neither prevents Facebook from violating state laws by using the images of minors without parental consent.
Facebook declined our offer for a recorded interview, but the company denies any wrongdoing and calls the latest offer fair and adequate. If this deal goes through, adults will get the chance to opt out of these sponsored stories, but just for 2 years. And parents will be able to prevent their kids' images from showing up in these ads as well. But for that to happen, the parent has to be on Facebook. Both the child and the parent have to tell Facebook they're related to each other. And then the parent has to dig through Facebook settings and find the right button to click to turn sponsored stories off. Georgetown law professor Heidi Lee Feldman says that's laughable.
Do you know what is hilarious about that? That is just becomes another data collection mechanism for Facebook. I mean, just think about how valuable it would be to find out who's related to whom on Facebook. For marketing purposes? My God.
And many parents, like Kim Natalie Parsons, the mom from Tennessee, are proposing a simpler idea. They've asked the court to require Facebook to stop using images of their children in advertising, period. And Parsons says if the company wants to use her picture in an ad, it should have to ask her first, each and every time. Steve Henn, NPR News, Silicon Valley.
Support for All Tech Considered comes from Carbonite, automatic and encrypted cloud backup solutions that provide access to backed-up files from any device. Carbonite.com.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Welcome to Regal Entertainment.
Randy Smith Jr. has been working for more than a decade to build a personal device for deaf people that would allow them to enjoy movies. Something that didn't require special screenings and wasn't bulky. Something that would simply put captions on the screens. And now, that device is here. They're glasses that project the captions on a screen in the form of a hologram, floating about 10 feet in front of the person using them. Sort of like 3D glasses for captioning. Sony and Regal Cinemas have partnered up to create the first batch, and they'll be distributed to about 6,000 theaters across the country this month. For Randy Smith Jr., the project was also personal. His son Ryan is deaf and a self-proclaimed cinephile. Ryan was the first tester of the devices throughout the years.
It has been our goal for, you know, I'd say 15 years to develop a technology that would allow accessibility to the deaf and the blind for every showtime, for every feature. So it took us a long time, but as technologies would be developed, we'd meet with them and they would send me prototypes and I'd come home and I'd basically say, you know, Ryan, tonight we're going to go see a film and test a new technology. And he would give me feedback as to what he liked or didn't like, and we'd send that back to the technology manufacturer, and they'd tweak it.
So now that you're perfecting the technology and getting it out there, what is this going to mean for your family and the deaf community?
You know, it's hard for me to put into words. I actually got an email from a parent yesterday. If we had the time, I'd read you a couple words, because I think he said it best.
If you're able to, we'd love to hear that.
I've attempted to enjoy a movie with my son so many times over the last 26 years, but to no avail. After watching a movie, I would try to discuss it with him. The comments he would make would in no way relate to the plot of the movie. At one point, he finally confessed that as he watched the screen, he simply made up the story in his head since he didn't really know what was going on. The fact that I can take my son to a movie when he visits at the end of June is literally bringing tears to my eyes. It would seem silly to most people, but I would imagine you understand what it feels like. I don't think I can express it any better than that.
Yeah, I mean, it's something that we all take for granted so much. That's pretty pretty moving.
It is, and when you have children and, you know, the forms of entertainment that we as a society engage in, movies are a big part of it. And when you completely eliminate that option for your children or one child has to be left behind, you know, that's going to tear at your heartstring.
So you have this in 6,000 of your theaters now. How long do you think it'll take before this gets to be widespread and out there everywhere?
Regal is going to be complete at the end of this month, but most all of them will be complete by the end of this year.
Randy, congratulations again. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you for having me, Arun.
That was Randy Smith Jr., Chief Executive Officer for Regal Cinemas.
This week, thousands of techies are pouring into San Francisco for Google's annual developers conference. Last year, Google's co-founder, Sergey Brin, used this event to unveil Google Glass, his company's attempt to transform the world of wearable computers. Google Glass is not for sale yet, but as NPR's Steve Henn reports in our Business Bottom Line, this product, which attaches a camera and tiny screen to your face, is already facing a backlash.
Google won't start selling Glass to consumers until the end of the year at the earliest. But already, Saturday Night Live has weighed in.
What are your early thoughts?
Oh, Seth, they're amazing. You know, I used to spend so much time in my life looking down at my phone, and now, thanks to Google Glass, the phone is up here, and I could use it without being rude or distracting.
The New York Times ran a front-page story about Google Glass and privacy, and the gadget's been banned from bars in Seattle and casinos in Las Vegas. But for the earnest Googlers who helped create Glass and the enthusiastic techies who've already gotten their hands on a pair, all this hate can be a little bewildering. Most of the people who I've talked to who have a pair just love them.
You know, taking a hike on a Sunday and just like, you know, been blown away by like taking pictures and just like taking video with it.
Got cooking instructions through Glass, and the friend that I was hanging out with could see what I was doing. And she was like, no, that's all wrong. Try it again, which is really, really helpful. I didn't expect it to be in that situation.
Mary Lambert and Javier Echevarria work at Google. These guys have had Glass for a couple months. Martin Petraca used it to give his family in Argentina a tour of San Francisco.
I was like, oh, this is where I go. This is what I do. And they just love it. I don't know.
Now, while you were doing that, did your family see lots of people like do double takes and stare at you?
Oh, yeah, totally.
Right now, Google Glass might be the world's worst spy camera. If you go out in public with a pair on, you're guaranteed to attract attention. Still, the idea of techies mounting tiny screens and little cameras to their faces makes millions of people uncomfortable.
Google has been incredibly transparent, pun intended, with its Glass rollout.
Sarah Rotman Epps is a tech analyst at Forrester Research. She says there's a good reason for this.
They realize that Google Glass will require shifting social norms to be accepted.
In that regard, the last few weeks have been rough for Google. If the company's going to turn around the public's impression of this product, they'll need some help. Help from people like Sarah Hill.
I am a storyteller for the Veterans United Network, and I'm also a volunteer for Veterans Virtual Tours.
Hill wants to use Google Glass to take World War II vets on virtual tours of places they may now be too old or frail to visit in person.
Places like the World War II Memorial, the Arlington National Cemetery, Pearl Harbor even.
Hill's convinced that leading a virtual tour for veterans while wearing Google Glass would be completely different for them than showing the group, say, a DVD.
Can I hear the waves? Can you bring me closer to the waves on the beaches of Normandy? Can you bring me closer to that inscription? Can I hear the waterfalls that are going in the middle of the World War II Memorial? And when people ask those World War II veterans, have you ever seen your memorial before they pass away? They can say, yes, I did.
At least virtually. Google's hoping that people like Hill could begin to help the public imagine the positive things they can do with this gadget. And Sam Abar wants to use it and build an app to identify packaged foods that are free of the allergens that make his son sick.
You know, I think glass could actually be really helpful for, you know, 5 to 10 million families in the United States that are dealing with food allergies.
For tech enthusiasts, the upsides seem obvious.
Yeah, I mean, it's well, I've spent my life essentially helping to build the internet, and this thing is basically the internet in your field of vision.
For Mark Andreessen, who created Netscape, that sounds awesome.
I mean, for me, that's the big thing. I mean, that's like the killer app.
But
has your spouse been tempted to rip them off your face and throw them out the window?
I think that she's been tempted to do that with almost every piece of gadgetry we own.
And battles like that could ultimately determine if Google Glass becomes the next iPhone or has a fate more like Apple's Newton. Steve Henn, NPR News, Silicon Valley.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Audie Cornish, and it's time now for All Tech Considered. It's another way television is moving online. Starting tomorrow, ABC will let viewers in New York and Philadelphia watch their local stations over the internet. But this is not a way to cut your cable bill. NPR's Dan Bobkoff is here to explain. So, Dan, what is new here?
Well, if you have an iPad or an iPhone or a Kindle or a computer, starting tomorrow around this time, if you live in New York City or Philadelphia, you'll be able to fire up an app called Watch ABC and stream your local station as if you're watching it on TV. So this is different from the other online services they had. As of right now, you can actually watch primetime shows online after they air on TV. But this is the first time a broadcast over-the-air local channel is going to let you watch their feed online for free. That's your local news, your daytime talk shows, primetime dramas, all that, all live. So this is just the beginning. Over the summer and into the fall, it will expand to cities like Los Angeles, San Francisco, and Chicago. And eventually, ABC expects most of its affiliates will be on board.
So what's the point? Why are they doing this?
Well, as you know, many people are starting to wonder if cable is worth it, and they're thinking of cutting the cord and going online only since they can get content from Netflix and Amazon and other places. This is a way that the industry is trying to cement the system they've had in place for a long time, even as more people are watching TV and video online anyway. So they're going where the viewers are going, but they're scared that people are going to cancel their cable subscriptions. So what they've done here is they forced you to log into this app using your cable company's username and password. So they know you're a subscriber. Even if you're in the office or you're out of your home, they know who you are and that you pay for cable each month.
Okay, so you have to have cable. I mean, even if you're watching online or you were trying to cut the cord, you have to have cable to use this.
Right. Now, you'd think that ABC is one of those few channels that you could set up an antenna and get for free over the air, which is true, but most Americans watch all the broadcast channels through cable. And cable has actually become a very important revenue stream for the local affiliates of ABC, CBS, and NBC, which over the past few years have actually been demanding fees from the cable companies per customer. So when you pay your cable bill, you might actually be paying a dollar for ABC, a dollar for CBS. And for these local stations that have a big decline in advertising revenue, that's become a very important source of revenue. And by locking you into cable, they are trying to maintain that.
So what does this mean for tomorrow when the ABC app is going to be available to certain customers?
Right. So if you're in New York or Philadelphia, you'll be able to pull up this app on your phone or your tablet, and you can hit the live button and see more or less what you see on your TV from your local affiliate. The biggest difference will be the ads. ABC says they've actually built in the ability to serve up targeted ads. So they know who you are, they know what you like, and at least theoretically, you could get different ads than your friends. This is not going to be on day one, but they already have this technology in there, and you can bet it is coming down the line.
And ABC is the first broadcast channel to do this. And what about their competitors?
Right, the first over-the-air channel to do this. You can already watch a lot of cable channels this way, ESPN, CNN, to name a few. But expect some of their broadcast competitors to follow suit. There's some speculation around CBS, which has already invested in an online streaming company that many say could help CBS launch something similar down the line.
That's NPR's Dan Bobkoff. Dan, thank you.
Thank you.
When we die, hopefully we leave the people who knew us with memories. For the closest friends and families, we might even leave some material possessions. But what about our digital possessions, our emails, computerized documents, and Facebook accounts? Stan Alcorn reports on how businesses are helping people handle their online remains.
Dr. Stephen Kelly has only 28 Facebook friends, but when he logs into his son John's account, he has more than 1,000. He only does that once or twice a year, like the day before I spoke with him, which was the second anniversary of John's suicide.
It's a little bit unusual. I do leave a message. I post a message from us, just thanking people for remembering him.
The message appears to come from John, but Dr. Kelly signs it himself.
Let me just get it exactly. I have to get online for a second.
He also reads messages that others leave for his son, like this one from an organization that John volunteered with to try to stop war crimes in Africa.
John, we miss you so much. We are deeply thankful that we got to know you and seek justice alongside of you. So, things like that come up.
Dr. Kelly is only able to stay in touch like this because he could log in using John's password. That's not recommended by Jim Lamb, an estate planning lawyer and digital property expert.
Do people do this? Yes, because it's easy and people think they're not going to get caught, and they may be right. I can't advise people to potentially break the law.
There are two kinds of law that Lamb says make digital property different. One kind is about data privacy. For example, after the death of a British model, Facebook successfully fought turning over her account to her mother by saying these privacy laws made that, quote, unauthorized access. But the second kind of law goes even further.
Even if I leave my password to my spouse or my personal representative of my estate, I may be violating my contract with Facebook.
If you violate your contract with Facebook or Google or Yahoo, you could be breaking the 1986 Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. It's kind of a mess, but a mess that a number of businesses are taking advantage of. At Internet Media Labs in the Flatiron District of New York City, 17 companies share a big open office. One of them is AfterSteps. It's kind of like TurboTax, but for death.
Okay, so I'll take you through?
Sure.
All right.
Jessica Bloomgarden, the company's founder, leads me through the process, uploading my will, choosing a healthcare proxy, and then there's the section for digital accounts.
Add your digital account usernames and passwords below so that your family can cancel, delete, or update them as you instruct.
She knows that's against a lot of online companies' policies.
So it's really more about giving that person options as opposed to adhering to whatever policies, you know, these organizations or companies are setting.
Those policies are starting to change. Last month, Google announced a kind of digital estate planner that you can set to delete or share data from your Google account if you haven't logged in for a while. And legislators are looking to modernize those out-of-date computer laws, too. If that happens, your email and social media accounts could become more like boxes of letters under the bed that you may not want your relatives to read after you're gone.
I don't think my parents are going to spend a lot of time going through my email.
But if there are messages you want to take to your grave, you might be better off keeping them offline. For NPR News, I'm Stan Alcorn in New York.